Welcome to Consider the Constitution, the podcast that cuts through the noise and provides insight into constitutional issues that directly affect every American. Hosted by Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey and featuring interviews with constitutional scholars, policy and subject matter experts, heritage professionals, and legal practitioners, we examine the rights and responsibilities of citizenship. Consider the Constitution is brought to you by the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
Hello, welcome back to Consider the Constitution. I'm your host, Dr. Katie Crawford Lackey, Director of the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Today, we're exploring the crossroads of gender equality, history, and law as we consider the legacy of the 19th Amendment. Ratified in 1920, the 19th Amendment protected women's voting rights, which is also known as suffrage. Beginning with the first organized effort to demand equality at the 1848 Seneca Falls Convention, it took women another 72 years to ensure their suffrage rights through a constitutional amendment. As we'll learn about today, the 19th Amendment was a significant milestone in the fight for gender equality in the United States. However, it did not apply to all women, particularly African American women who still faced discrimination at the polls, as well as indigenous women who were not granted citizenship until 1924. And even with constitutional protection of their suffrage rights, women still faced various forms of discrimination and inequality in areas such as employment, education, healthcare, and more. Joining us for this discussion is Dr. Julie Sook, an interdisciplinary comparative legal scholar researching equality at the intersection of law, history, sociology, and politics in the U.S. and globally. She is currently a faculty member at the Fordham University School of Law. Dr. Sook has authored dozens of articles and book chapters about comparative constitutional law. She is also the author of several books, including her most recent publication, After Misogyny, How the Law Fails Women and What to Do About It, released in 2023. Welcome, Julie. It's really an honor to have you on the show today.
Thanks so much. It's a real honor for me to join you.
As we begin our discussion of the 19th Amendment and its effects on America, both in the past and today, I'd like to begin by discussing what the struggle for women's equality looked like before the ratification of the 19th Amendment. Can you provide us some context information?
Well, before the 19th Amendment became constitutional law, women voted in some states, but not in others. And that's because some states, especially Western states like Wyoming, granted women suffrage pretty early on, as early as 1869 in Wyoming, and a lot of Western states followed. But many state constitutions explicitly said that only male citizens could vote. So that was entrenched in many state constitutions throughout the country. So you had this variety throughout the nation, and initially, the movement for women's suffrage tried to concentrate on changing each state one at a time. And this really begins with an explicit demand for the right to vote in the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. But after the 1848 convention, there were many more conventions. Almost every year, women gathered in various places to spell out their demands for change. And by 1878, that's a generation after Seneca Falls, the first bill to propose women's suffrage was introduced in Congress. And another really important part of this landscape before the 19th Amendment is constitutional amendment activity and movements in general. The other really important movement that women were involved in since Seneca Falls and leading all the way up to the time that the 19th Amendment was ratified is the women's temperance movement. It's important to note that the Women's Christian Temperance Union, the WCTU, was actually the largest women's political organization in the United States by the end of the 19th century. They were actually bigger than the suffrage organizations. And it's very important that the leader of that organization, Frances Willard, just called for women's suffrage. And women were interested in temperance because there were a lot of social problems caused by male drunkenness, and it affected women's lives. If there was male drunkenness and domestic violence, or husband spending too much money on alcohol because of the liquor industry having too much power, all of these things affected women's day-to-day lives because, remember, the vote was not the only right that they were missing. They also did not have rights to control their own lives in terms of employment, keeping their earnings, controlling their property. So they were really at the mercy of their husbands and sometimes also their fathers. And because women were at the mercy of men during this period, they joined the temperance movement and they used the political power that was gaining ground because of the temperance movement to advocate for women's suffrage. So it's not a coincidence that you get the Prohibition Amendment 1 year before the suffrage amendment. And there's a lot of momentum that builds up in that decade before the 19th Amendment is passed, because there are other amendments, including the Income Tax Amendment, the 16th Amendment, and then the 17th Amendment, which leads to the direct vote by people for their senators in every state. These are all moves towards greater democracy, and these are all part of the general landscape by which we should understand how the women's movement for suffrage succeeds by 1920.
Julie, you're describing this kind of women being empowered and being involved politically, even though they don't have suffrage rights at this point. And with women able to vote in some states and not others, there's this kind of uneven equality that's happening in America at the time. What is it that causes women who were advocating for suffrage rights at Seneca Falls Convention, in addition to other rights, to shift from this state-by-state approach where women are enfranchised through the state constitutions to a focus on passing a national amendment, an amendment to the U.S. Constitution?
So you've really put your thumb on the central paradox. How do you get the right to vote when you can't vote? You have zero say if you don't have the right to vote. So who's deciding in each state whether women should vote? And the fact is, it's really a male electorate and men who are representatives in the state legislatures. And this begins to change a little bit because the Western states, many Western states, start enfranchising women. And that means that women are voting for their members of Congress, for example. So you have a little bit of a voice in Congress that you're missing in those states that limit suffrage to men only. So that creates an opening now. Now, it's not a huge opening because, remember, to get a constitutional amendment under Article 5, you need 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of state legislatures. So the small opening of voice created by women voting in a handful of states is not great, but it's a platform that can be used that's different from going state by state. And I'll also give you just some facts about amending state constitutions. If you have a state constitution that says only men can vote, you need to amend that state constitution. And a lot of state constitutions had significant barriers, specifically if the problem you're trying to solve is enfranchising women. And that is that to amend many state constitutions, this is different from the federal constitution, there would often be a referendum. And this is true today. Of all the 50 states, in 49 states, you have a referendum to ratify a constitutional amendment. People actually go and vote on a constitutional amendment. That's not true of Article 5. But what that meant in many states is that you would have a proposal to enfranchise women, but who votes? Only men get to vote on that proposal. And so then the proposal would be rejected. Massachusetts is a very important example. In 1915, there was a referendum on women's suffrage that failed. And this is the paradox. It's very hard to get the right to vote when you don't have the right to vote because the women are not voting in those referendums. So by comparison, Article 5 is also really hard, but at least in Article 5, if you have a few members of Congress who are there because they cared about what women voters thought. In some places where women are voting, you can't win a seat unless you pay some attention to what women voters care about. Then that changes the dynamic and makes, even though the federal constitutional amendment rule is also extremely difficult to use, it creates a different political dynamic than in a state where a referendum of male voters will produce the outcome of depriving women of the vote.
And as we look at what it took to pass the 19th Amendment. As you described, this is a very different approach than trying to amend a state constitution. What led up to this push for this constitutional amendment? This is a new generation of suffragists coming in. What does the political landscape look like at the time?
Well, I think there were a lot of strategic disagreements about whether they should focus on a state-by-state approach or a federal constitutional amendment. And some of those disagreements were generational within the women's suffrage movement. I think that the success of amendments that move towards greater democracy, including the income tax amendment and the direct election of senators amendment, as well as the prohibition amendment, created a landscape in which federal constitutional amendment seemed like something that could be used to democratize the nation. And so I think that probably played a role. Another huge factor is the status and role of women during World War I. When you have a nation at war, it creates certain disruptions, and you have more women in some traditionally male roles. So women are working more because the men are at war. There is a wartime economy. And another huge issue for the women's suffrage movement was whether or not women were going to support the war effort as a political matter. Because certainly there were pacifists who thought that it was a real mistake for the United States to get involved in a war in Europe. But I think one of the strategic decisions that was made by Carrie Chapman Catt and other women suffrage activists was to support the United States' entry into World War I. And I think by doing that, it really created this message that how women voted could make a real difference to the political future of this country. And I think that was why you get the passage and relatively quick ratification, which, frankly, a lot of people weren't expecting. People weren't expecting the 19th Amendment to be ratified as quickly as it was.
And with the ratification in 1920, this is a big deal, not just in terms of the symbolism for women's equality, you know, a step in the right direction, but it's roughly half of the population of the United States that's now enfranchised.
Yes.
How does this affect America and what's happening politically in 1920? Thinking about while women were enfranchised, it did not include all women, and there are still some barriers.
Yes. So let's be clear about what the 19th Amendment did and didn't do. It automatically invalidated those existing state laws, many of which were clauses in state constitutions that defined eligible voters as male only. So even though we call it the Women's Suffrage Amendment, or we talk about it as guaranteeing the right to vote for women, it is not an amendment that said that every citizen has a constitutional right to vote, period. We still don't have a constitutional right to vote at the federal level in the United States, and that's a little bit distinctive about the United States. What the 19th Amendment said was the right of citizens to vote shall not be abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex, and it's important also, if we think about the status of Black women, the 19th Amendment does technically apply to Black women, but because it says on account of sex, it doesn't really speak to poll taxes, literacy taxes, intimidation. There are a lot of things that are happening, particularly in southern states, to stop Black people, both men and women, from voting. And because technically that is not an abridgment on account of sex, the 19th Amendment is pretty toothless to do anything about those practices that essentially kept Black people, including Black women, from voting, particularly in the South. So what that means, though, is that also note that it says the right of citizens to vote. It's not talking generally about women's equal rights or the right to be free from sex discrimination in employment, in property rights, in the right to exercise parental authority over your own children. And so in all of those areas, which affect perhaps more so than voting, it affects women's day-to-day lives. Can I get a job? If I get a job, can I keep that money or does my husband control that money? If I end up getting divorced, do I have rights to custody and parental authority over my own children? Those kinds of things. And that's why the Equal Rights Amendment was proposed, to deal with the full set of issues involving the rights of women, to equalize those rights. The Equal Rights Amendment is considered the logical next step after women's suffrage, and it's introduced in 1923. And there is a century-long and ongoing struggle for that amendment.
Julie, you make an important distinction between what the 19th Amendment actually says versus what actually happens as a result of its ratification. So as you point out, Black women have the legal right to vote, but there are other obstacles and barriers put in place to prevent them and Black men from voting in the South especially. And you kind of are addressing some of the thoughts that are running through my head in terms of, yes, this is a huge step forward for women. They have the ability now to say what happens in their communities on the national level by voting for representatives. However, there's a lot that is left unaddressed, it sounds like, in terms of the other rights and privileges that affect their day-to-day lives in the 1920s up through the present.
Yeah, so I don't want to underestimate the importance of the 19th Amendment. I spoke to some of the things the 19th Amendment didn't do, but it is important to appreciate what it does do, particularly as a political matter. It completely changes the landscape of politics if now, if you want to be a political leader, if you want to be a representative, you have to care about women voters. As you said, they are half, possibly more than half of the population. And we do see some very important policy achievements in the 1920s, which can be explained by heightened awareness of women voting. Specifically, there's the Sheppard-Towner Act, which appropriates federal money to protect maternal health and infant health. That's a really important step because that's something that's passed out of awareness that women now have a voice in national politics. Another thing that you see is a change to one area of law in which there was sex discrimination. Specifically, before the 1920s, the law made it so that if you were a woman who was an American citizen married to a foreigner, you would lose your American citizenship. And Congress passed a law to correct that so that that would not happen anymore. If you were a U.S. citizen capable of voting, you didn't lose that citizenship by marrying a foreigner. So these are important steps in policy that can be linked to a greater awareness of women's voice in politics. But many political scientists have also shown that you see a little bit less of an influence of this awareness of women's voice later on in the decade because women start voting more based on their political party rather than as a bloc. There were efforts by Alice Paul, who is perhaps one of the most famous suffragists, to create a specific party called the National Woman's Party that would have women across the spectrum voting as a bloc, creating a real force. But that really doesn't materialize in the United States. And really, since the 19th Amendment, you see more women voting by their partisan orientation rather than as a category, women. And I think that what that means is that it's harder to identify policies that are changing because of women voting.
You describe the introduction of the Equal Rights Amendment after the ratification of the 19th Amendment and how women become part of this, you know, political process of voting. What happens with this suffrage movement into the late 1920s, 1930s? Does it dissipate or is there still a lot of energy around achieving women's equality in America?
I think there's certainly a lot of energy around achieving equality for women in America, but there is disagreement between women who used to agree on suffrage. There's disagreement about what it'll take to achieve equality for women in America. And that disagreement gets played out for decades over the Equal Rights Amendment. And it's important to understand the overall legal landscape in which women are talking about whether the Equal Rights Amendment is actually going to help them, because the Equal Rights Amendment is supposed to get rid of all sex discrimination in the law. That's how we understand what it means to say equality rights should not be abridged on account of sex. So if you get rid of all sex discrimination in the law, one problem was that there were some laws that were designed to protect women in the workplace, and they were particularly helpful to working class women in industries. So it protected women's wages, like a women's minimum wage, or the right to certain working conditions that were safer and more compatible with women's reproductive role. So there was a real disagreement about whether those laws would be preserved by the Equal Rights Amendment. And if it's not compatible with legal equality, will women be worse off or better off with having gender-neutral laws applying to everyone? And this is a very difficult question with which we still struggle today. If you have laws that can't treat women differently ever, then can you have affirmative action for women in areas where they're underrepresented or disadvantaged, right? That's a genuine question that I think we are still grappling with. But those are the kinds of conflicts that led people to disagree on whether or not the Equal Rights Amendment should be the highest priority. And if it's not the highest priority, then what should the focus be? So one strand that develops in the 20s, and we're still seeing conflicts about that strand, is advocating for women's reproductive autonomy. But there were also some divisions as to whether or not that should be a priority. Or advocating for women's access to credit, women's access to economic security through access to employment, women's access to political power. So there are so many issues that cause women's disadvantage in America in the 1920s, and they evolve in very interesting ways. And because of the multiplicity of issues and the complex evolution, there continues to be disagreements even within those who advocate for women's equality as to what the priorities should be.
So this Equal Rights Amendment introduced in the 1920s, but as you reference, there's perhaps some different ideas about what equality looks like, what should be included in terms of if the Equal Rights Amendment becomes part of the Constitution. And today, it still has not passed, so it's not part of the Constitution at present. But Julie, as we close out today, what would America look like if that amendment was ratified and became part of the U.S. Constitution?
The Equal Rights Amendment would be a brand new amendment added to the Constitution in the 21st century. And I would like to remind listeners that we have not had a constitutional amendment in the 21st century. The last time we had an amendment was 1992, and I would hardly call it a modern amendment because James Madison was the author of the amendment that finally got ratified and added to the Constitution in 1992. So that takes us back to 1970, 71, when we have the amendment that's actually passed by Congress in the 70s and ratified by the states in the 70s. So I think that the importance of the Equal Rights Amendment is that it is a step towards adding something new to the Constitution in the 21st century. And this is important specifically with regard to equal rights for women, because having something new that's added in the 21st century definitely has some legal and political advantages over the current method of squeezing gender equality and gender rights out of constitutional provisions that were written and adopted in 1868 after the Civil War. We saw with the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case that it's actually pretty difficult to read the right to reproductive autonomy or abortion into the 14th Amendment's Due Process Clause, because the Due Process Clause just references liberty and was passed at a moment when perhaps abortion was not at the front and center of what the framers of that amendment were thinking about. And because you have a Supreme Court that tends to value the original meaning of any constitutional provision that they're tasked with enforcing, it makes it really difficult to see anything that's already in the Constitution as a robust source of gender equality or gender rights. So if the ERA is added to the Constitution in 2024 or any time after, the original public meaning of that amendment would include 21st century understandings of gender equality. And just, it should go without saying that our gender expectations today are totally different from the gender expectations of 1868. And I would say it's actually hard to imagine living in the modern post-industrial world as a fully equal citizen if the government forces you to keep a pregnancy you don't want or to risk your life to turn an unborn fetus into a child. So I think that the Equal Rights Amendment, if it were added today to the Constitution, would have to grapple with those 21st century meanings. I don't know that the 21st century meanings are agreed to by everyone. We might have respectful disagreements about what it means for abortion and what it means specifically for the state's role in guaranteeing equal pay. But I think it would change the conversation because the method by which we would arrive at what constitutional gender equality means would be anchored to the 21st century rather than to the 19th century.
Dr. Julie Sook, thank you for speaking with us today. You left us with all this great information and have certainly sparked some of my thoughts about not only what does equality look like today, especially in terms of gender, but how do we actually implement that through policy, through a U.S. constitutional amendment? And it's interesting to consider what enfranchisement, gaining these suffrage rights through the 19th Amendment, did for women, but also the steps that we still need to take to ensure equality.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure talking with you today, Katie.
And I'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in today. Please share this show with your family and friends and tune in 2 weeks for our next episode of Consider the Constitution.